This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 91 of the DTV Digest. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me, as usual, is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
Yes, we've had a bit of a break. You know, sort of work and other things getting in the way, unfortunately. But we've had a bit of a think about the format of the show, and we've decided to slim it down a bit. It was becoming a little bit bloated, and, you know, there's certain sections which probably sort of work better in other media. So, for example, the DTV chart and the coming soons, and possibly the washing up as well, you'll start to find on our Twitter and Facebook pages. If you just type in the DTV Digest, I'm sure you'll find us very easily. So please click and subscribe to those platforms. So this week, in the sort of new slimmed down version, we've got two main reviews, which is the William Kaufman directed Louis Mandelor starring The Brave, and also the Italian MMA thriller MMA Love Never Dies, which is a very interesting film indeed. Our short shot this week is The Bounty, and our DTV throwback is actually a double bill. The Corey Haim starring Demolition High and Demolition You. So look forward to those when we get to them. But first, let's crack on. Our first feature this week, then, is The Brave, directed by William Kaufman, the director I highly admire, and starring Louis Mandelor, an actor that both me and Rich really admire as well. In this one, Mandelor stars as Ray, a detective who's been working undercover in an Albanian town which is rife with drugs, run by the nefarious Armand Asante. I guess that Mickey Rourke was unavailable for this one. So this is a battle of wits between the police and the drug dealers. Turns out both maybe have a mole working on the inside. And it's an interesting police procedural. It has its flaws. It really does have its flaws. But I still thoroughly enjoyed this, Rich.
Yeah, was it? Because I know you were really looking forward to it. Did it meet the expectations, or what was it that, you know? What were your favourite parts and your least favourite parts before I sort of interject?
Before you jump in, okay. So the first thing I think we have to mention is the fact that this is a mostly Albanian cast, speaking in English. So there, you know, there is a bit of an issue with accents in this film and people trying to act through a different language. Not entirely successful. At times, a particular mole, for example, his line reading is pretty awful all the way through the film. So that, you know, that's, people are going to struggle with the accents, I think. There's a great shootout sequence where they raid this this brothel. I thought that was really well done. There's a huge battle at the end, but unfortunately, it suffers from red shirt syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have this army of police SWAT officers wearing full tactical gear and helmets and masks and stuff, who literally just walk into bullets. You know, they just run around corners and get sort of shot to bits. And these are supposed to be highly trained officers, and they're just sort of like gleefully running into gunfire. But it's almost as if the heroes are sort of using these guys as decoys, because as soon as they got shot, then they pop around the corner and shoot somebody. So that was really, really annoying after, you know, after some good build up earlier on. And you know, this big shootout is, should have been really epic, but I'm just sort of watching all these guys just get mowed down, and it's almost like the opposite of something like Commando, where you got like one guy chasing all the bad guys and just mowing them down. You know,
yeah.
This is an army of police officers, highly trained supposedly, can't shoot for shit, got no sort of like awareness of where they are or what's going on, which was very annoying. Meanwhile, our three heroes are running around without helmets on, you know, possibly without even bulletproof vests. and it seemed to be sort of bulletproof for the whole sort of last sort of 15 minutes of the film. But yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, that, I mean, sort of jumping straight to the sort of crux of the problem, I think the that last half, I think it's like 20 minutes or half an hour,
it's a good
of where story. It's like, this is the final act, we're going in for the big action sequence and the never-ending gunfire and stuff. Yeah. Just completely lost me there, unfortunately. It was, I think, the first two parts of the film are really promising. And then, you know, in terms of giving it a good score, the final act, you know, brought it down for me.
Yeah.
Which was a real shame.
As I said, you know, that whole brothel sequence I thought was really good. You know, and that was sort of twinned with the, you know, the armed escort of the prisoners getting ambushed. And that also was sort of pretty well done. And at least those cops seemed to know what they were doing and actually lasted more than a couple of seconds. You know, I mean, you know, they put up a pretty decent fight before being overpowered, which I kind of like as well. It's just, you know, obviously they must have been the cream of the crop and the rest of the guys were just the minions who just got totally wasted, you know, first day out of training sort of thing.
Let's go back to the beginning, because I thought the opening scene, which establishes the situation and Lewis Mandler's character and stuff, was very well done. I thought it was very tense.
Yes.
You know, they do that sort of sustained score kind of, you know, Dark Knight kind of thing where the music sort of builds up.
Ramping up. Yeah,
you get sort of unsettled. I think there's definitely some Dark Knight sort of influences in here. But
I thought that was a good
sequence. And then there's another, like you say, there's that raid sequence. Mm. There's like two or three really good action scenes.
And the thing about that particular bit at the beginning is you don't know who the good guys are.
No.
You know, at all. You obviously kind of guess that Louis Mandelon might be the good guy, but doesn't that mean that all the guys he's with are probably the good guys as well? You know, and it's the bad guys who are turning up, you know, to do the to do the deal, which I thought was quite good. He just didn't know who to trust at all.
Well, that's kind of the theme of the film, isn't it? It's like, who's good, who's bad, you're not quite sure, shades of grey. Amanda Sante is like the big bad wolf kind of thing, but even he has like this heroic backstory, and you know, there's a relationship between him and the chief, captain of the police.
He's really familiar, and I couldn't place him.
He's in loads of stuff. I think one of the most high profile things he did was Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Of course, yes, that's right. Yeah, he was one of the Soviet lieutenants or something. Yeah,
I think he's, because this, I think he's Bulgarian, because this is set in Albania, but largely shot in Bulgaria. So I think there's a few Bulgarian sort of contingent in there. I think he's done stuff like with New Image and that, which is why we recognise him.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, he's a big, tall, imposing guy. I quite liked him in this.
I do.
For a time, he's like the co-lead, or, you know, he's one of the leads, because this is more of an ensemble. It's not really Lewis Mandelor's film until the end. There's a whole, you know, unit, and each of them has got their own story, and that was another thing that sort of grated on me a little bit. It was like they all had this sort of moment where they shared a trauma or something.
Yeah.
This is quite a bleak film as well. I would stress there's lots of darkness here.
It all ties back to Albania's past, doesn't it? You know, there's even Louis Mandelor's character, who's I think he's like, you know, he's from Albania originally, then went to New York, and then he's come back.
He was orphaned, I think, during.
He was orphaned. All right, that was.
he watched his mother die, didn't he? And then he watched his father kill himself. It's like really serious trauma going on, and then there's another girl, she was forced into prostitution. There's a boy who gets shot. It's really, really bleak kind of stuff, but they're also saying, you know, we love, you know, Albania's great, you know, Albania's a beautiful country and whatever, and we're trying to, basically the whole crux of the film is they're trying to clean it up so they can join the European Union. I just want to sort of sidetrack to Amanda Sante's contribution, because he gets top billing here, and he's, like we say, the main villain, but he's not on screen a huge amount.
No.
But when he's on, I really liked him. I thought he was great. I don't know if he improvised or whether he was working from his script, but his lines seemed so typically Armand Asante in their sort of bizarreness in a way, and sort of the way he delivers them. No, he's very much a, you know, he's like channeling Marlon Brando in a lot of this stuff. Well, and as you say, Mickey Rourke does the same thing.
Yeah. Now, the last film we saw Armand Asante in was The Diamond Cartel, I think it was called. Cartel. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, I remember
it. It was a very weird film as well.
It was a very weird film, that was.
Probably one of the weirdest
ones. But yeah, it was interesting seeing him in this one. And, you know, as you say, the little ticks and things he does, you know, to bring to the role, which make it interesting. And as you say, you know, the past he has with the captain as well, you know, gives a bit of resonance. There's a particular scene late on where one of the characters does something and it sort of really, really fucks him off, which is really cool as well. You know, it's good to sort of see that side of him. You know, there is a sort of some code of honour or decency to him, you know, in there somewhere.
Now, did this film remind you, in particular with some of those, with like a couple of the scenes involving the captain, one of which was obviously with Armand Asante, did they remind you of any particular film? Because I got really strong vibes from that one particular film was a big influence on this.
Go on then.
Heat.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
You know when they get, you know when the assault sequence happens?
Yes.
You know, the when they're transferring the prisoner? That's really, really like the Heat sequence. Where they're wearing the masks and stuff and the big gunfire happens.
Yeah.
And so that and the scene in the police station where the two guys come face to face, which reminded me of the famous moment in, or the famous scene in Heat where Pacino and De Niro come together for the first time and, you know, sort of lay their cards on the table. It was like that was basically the same kind of movie. So that, I thought Heat was a huge influence on Kaufman with this film, whether that was intentional or, you know, it's just, you know, subconsciously, I think it's unmistakable, but also quite risky to sort of draw that sort of comparison.
Yeah.
But that said, I thought it was well executed. Both of those scenes that I'm referring to as being Heat influenced were very well done.
Yeah. Now, people who've got like a, you know, 4K HD TV will be definitely rewarded watching this film, because there are certain scenes, you know, those sort of intercut scenes where you're going from one place to another and you get like a city view or something, you know, just a transition from one scene to the next. Those scenes looked amazing, you know, from a sort of HD perspective. You know, the colour saturation and everything for those things was absolutely superb. In fact, I'm going to mention something similar in one of the other films talking about later on. But the lighting at the end of the film, after the gunfight's finished, and there's a scene of Louis Mandelor just sort of walking back to his vehicle, and the way the light catches him, you know, it really has this sort of poetic moment. It just looks spectacular. It really does. You know, and you know, you mentioned sort of, Heat. I mean, that sort of thing just reminds me of Miami Vice, sort of the very last scene of Miami Vice, when he walks back into the hospital and just cuts. It's that kind of scene. You know, it just looks great. The way he films sort of the three characters after the gun battle just really got me.
Yeah, I was trying to watch it in as best resolution as I could, because this was on special offer, folks, at Amazon Prime.
We do need to mention this. So
it came out a couple of weeks ago, and then this week, as we're recording, it was made available for $2.99. Now, that's $2.99 standard or high definition rental or purchase. So just for the hell of it, I thought, well, if I'm going to rent it, I might as well buy it.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, my connection is not, when I'm using Amazon, it always dips in and out. 1 minute it's nice and clear, next minute it's rough. It's been like that for ages, but which is one of the problems I have with Amazon Prime compared to like Netflix or, yeah. or such. But so it is a well shot film. Was it in like 16:9 or was it like widescreen with black bars? Because I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
I can't remember the ratio at all.
I don't think I had the black bars, to be honest.
No. Now, previously we've talked about Daylight's End. That's the only Kaufman film we've actually discussed on the show, which you were a big fan of, and I wasn't so much.
Yeah.
I like this more. I'm still not completely sold on Kaufman, because I think the only other films I've seen of his are The Prodigy and One in the Chamber, neither of which... you know, made much of an impression. I still haven't seen Sinners and Saints, which is the one that everyone talks about.
Yeah, that is really good. And that's why I like Johnny Strong so much as well from that film. The other one I've seen is this one with Cuba Gooding Jr. and Dolph Lundgren.
That's One in the Chamber.
Yeah, because Dolph Lundgren is nuts in that film. He's brilliant. Wandering around in like Hawaiian shirts and just not giving a shit. That was pretty decent as well.
And he also did another Cuba Gooding Jr. film called The Hit List, which I think I did see as well. That was again sort of proceduralish. I think it was like a cop movie or something. If I recall correctly, I might not be. And the other couple of films he's done was sequels: Jarhead 3 and Marine 4.
Yes. Jarhead 3 is the Scott Atkins one, which I love.
Now, getting back to The Brave, which, curiously, the original title was one of two. There was Lazarat and Lazarat Burning, which, having watched the film, I still couldn't figure out what that was referring to because it wasn't like the name of the town or anything.
No, I thought it might be.
No, it's because they said it was like Raya or something was the name of the town. So anyway, I don't know. But as far as sort of procedural action ensemble kind of movies go, I thought it was fine. I tell you what, you know, apart from like Heat, what the other film I was reminded of was the Steven Seagal film Born to Raise Hell.
Oh yeah.
Did you ever see that one?
I did.
Have you seen it?
That's just one of his sort of Russian ones, isn't it?
I think it was. It's made in Romania, but that's another say.
Is that the one where he's an actual cop?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the one with Daniel Shalavi.
Yes, Darren Shalavi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that movie was like, it felt like it should be an American story, but they put it in Bucharest or something as a location. So as with this, you know, everyone's speaking English and stuff. It's just sort of a bit jarring. At least with this one, they make more of an effort to make it like, it's a story about Albania and the people in it are Albanians. They just happen to be speaking English, which is a bit, that's just, you know, Hollywood movies have been doing that for donkey's years, whatever, I'm not really open. So that's not so much of a fuss, but I was just thought it was funny that film particularly came to mind as just being a little bit similar. This is superior, obviously, because even though that had Darren Shalavi in it, you know, he wasn't used to the best effects. I liked quite a lot about it. I'd say Amanda Sante in particular, the chief I enjoyed, Louis Mandelor when he got a couple of big scenes, you know, the bit when he's like throwing the chair, he's really upset and he breaks it. This film seems to have been shot on a very, very restricted budget because there's like only a couple of, it's only a handful of locations and they're quite sparsely decorated and stuff. So I think they did quite well. I would have gone a 7, but because of that final act being just too drawn out and for me quite uninvolving, I'm dropping it down to a 6. I also couldn't understand the final lines of Amanda Sante. I had like two goes at trying to hear what he was saying and I just couldn't catch it.
I can't help it. I'm going to stick with a 7. I think that final sequence is ridiculous, mainly because, and I can see why they did it, you know, there's limited budget and everything, you cover everyone up in high tactical gear, you can reuse the same actors over and over again, you know, I totally understand that, but the fact that they just like bullet sponges, you know, just wound me up a bit. But there you go. But I'm going to stick with the 7. I thought overall the action was really good. Really like Mandalore. Amanda Sante's good value. So yeah, there you go. 7 and a 6 for The Brave. Our second review this week is MMA Love Never Dies. In this one we have two brothers, Claudio and Michelle. Michelle is a champion of mixed martial arts, while his brother is a police detective. When Michelle is injured after refusing to throw a fight and his daughter kidnapped, Claudio springs into action. But he is blackmailed into getting back into the ring himself and taking on a new champion in order to rescue his niece. Okay, so I had no clue what this film was. The title is just bizarre for a start. MMA, Love Never Dies. I thought it was like a love letter to MMA. You know, I don't know if this is going to be a documentary or anything. And then it starts off in the most sleaziest way possible.
It's a pretty sleazy film.
It's a pretty sleazy film overall. You know, it's Italian. We'll be up front. This is Italian. It's subtitled. And the opening scenes of, you know, which just do not make sense. You know, there's a couple having sex. We don't know who they are. You know, I was thinking, oh, is this the brother? What's going on? But no, they're just two people randomly having sex while in another room somebody's having cocaine.
I think it's established. They establish at the end that they're like dealing with the drugs or something, and then it sort of segues to another. But yeah, they're ripping them off or something. Yeah.
That's right.
But yeah, that is a completely gratuitous scene to open the movie with lots of pole dancing and
lots of nudity, all this sort of stuff going on. Anyway, so we have a guy called, who's the main guy?
So Claudio.
No. Who's the main bad guy?
Oh, Rocco. Rocco. Malatesta.
The one below him, the one who runs the MMA stuff.
Oh, okay. I can't even remember what his name
is. Anyway, never mind. Ido, I think it is. Might be Ido. Anyway, Ido is trying to convince his boss, Rocco, that this MMA stuff is making money, man. You know, and he tries to sort of show his boss that, yeah, we can make a shitload of money by fixing the fights. But unfortunately for him, Michelle decides that he doesn't want to take a dive and instead beats the shit out of his opponent. Loses the mob, lots of money, and they come after him. And now the debt falls on his brother Claudio. And then Claudio...
Pretty... not the smartest thing to have done, really.
Really, no.
Just for his own pride or whatever, I don't
exactly,
know.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and for his daughter's pride, I guess. But, Claudio gets a brilliant training montage, which is straight out of Rocky IV.
Absolutely. You know, best bit of the film. Even the score is basically Rocky IV.
It is so Rocky IV. You know, if you know when he's training in Siberia or wherever, you know, and he's lifting weights on pulleys and everything and doing one-handed push-ups and all that sort of stuff, running on the beach, you know, he does all that stuff, and he looks great doing it. It has to be
said. Yeah, he's in the beach and on the beach and in the breaker's yard.
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, pulling up all this, you know, heavy. Yeah, it's like, he's like using a sledgehammer on a car windscreen and all that stuff.
If you go to a gym, you know, you might think you probably see some of this sort of stuff going on these days anyway. But yeah, so, you know, he's a big guy anyway. You know, you look at him and you go, yeah, this guy works out anyway. But they're sort of going, no, he's out of shape, man. He's got to hit the gym. You've got to do this week-long intensive course with this this guy who's going to sort of get him ready for the fight.
Because even though he's a cop, he's a retired MMA fighter himself.
Yeah.
So he's lured back into the ring. So he's got to go back in for one last time.
Absolutely. You know, great fun. And he's also vilified by his boss because he never fires his gun. He keeps it locked in a drawer the whole time. You know, he's sort of it's so funny. You know, in today's world, a cop who never fires his gun should be, you know, a good thing. You know, but everyone's taking the piss out of him. You know, bloody hell, man. You know, people are going to die of tetanus from your gun rather than get shot by it. Sort of one of the lines that comes out. But you know, he proves that he goes on the range with his partner, and he wipes the floor with you know, the target practice thing. So it's not that he doesn't know how to use it; he just doesn't like it, which I thought was you know, a cool little sort of character moment. And it's
there's quite a lot of that sort of character moments in the film. Like, even you know, it starts off, you know, he's getting up and out of bed and whatever, and let's just pause for a moment while I put my insulin in. And then he's conflicted because he the reason he stopped fighting was because he crippled his opponent.
That was hilarious. I'm sorry.
So he has a lot. He has a lot. Yeah.
He takes his partner, his gorgeous female partner, to this restaurant, this cafe, and the proprietor of the cafe is a guy in a wheelchair, and you know, and he greets Claudio warmly and it's sort of friends and everything. And then you find out later on that Claudio broke his fucking back in a sparring match. You know, it wasn't even like a proper match. It was just like them sparring. And he broke the guy's back. And it's like, yeah, but we're still friends, you know.
And the reason that happened was because he was so angry about his relationship breaking apart because of the love of his life going off with his brother.
With his brother, indeed, yes. Which is never fully explained, is it? You know, I suppose that's a whole other movie, sort of delving into that sort of stuff. But
yeah, let's say there's quite a lot of sort of character stuff in it. Now, we'll just pause for a moment and just talk about Claudio himself, played by Claudio. So this is like almost autobiographical, so it's good. I don't know, what's the name of the... Yeah, so Claudio Falco is played by Claudio Del Falco. So they're basically using real names here, a bit Jackie Chan style, like some of the things. So, but he's an interesting looking guy. Do you know the actor Kim Coates?
Yes, yeah, I do know.
So I was thinking, this guy looks like a really muscular Kim Coates, but his hair's like really lank.
It's sort of a cross between Kim Coates and Fabio.
Yeah, probably more Mickey Rourke than Fabio, I don't know. But he's quite a distinctive looking guy, but he's got this sort of, I don't know, it's his eyes and stuff. It's like he's really, I don't know if that's just his acting performance. It's just he's trying to look that kind of conflicted, angry sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, he's not bad. And the rest of the cast do fine. But it's really interesting to see an Italian martial arts themed film.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever seen one.
No.
At least not in recent memory. Yeah. It's quite unusual, which kind of makes it all the more disappointing that the martial arts scenes actually aren't that good. I mean, it's not that there's no skills. It's just stuff's shot not very well,
you know,
and badly edited.
I mean, we could name about five fight choreographers off the top of our heads easily, you know, thinking, really, guys, you couldn't get one of these guys, you know, just for an afternoon or something, just to sort of help you out.
But even the climax, you know, Claudio's back in the ring for a big fight or whatever, it kind of comes to nothing, really. It's like a really it's not a memorable scene at all.
What's happening after the fight, aren't
you? Yeah, it's kind of the film continues on after that. So yeah, this is very much a sort of, I'm always looking at these things like The Brave and stuff, you know, seeing other influences, whatever. To me, this is a kickboxer movie. This is like Kickboxer 6, you know, like not Kickboxer 1, although the Kickboxer 1 template is kind of there, but it's kind of been changed and sort of, it's one of the lesser sequels in the way it's in the execution. Yeah.
I was kind of reminded of there's a really good Gary Daniels one where he's sort of forced back into the ring.
Is that Forced to Fight?
Forced to Fight, yeah. I was kind of reminded of that a little bit. But obviously the martial arts are so much better in that film than this.
I do want to see that one.
It is good. Yeah, I really enjoyed that one, actually.
Peter Weller as well in it, didn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I was talking earlier when we were talking about The Brave about the sort, you know, the HD aspect. There's one particular sequence in this film towards the beginning where you're looking at this sort of old building and this sort of a lake thing, and it's a sort of time lapse scene where, you know, it goes from sort of early morning through to night, in the space of a couple of minutes. And that scene, it just looked amazing. You know, it really did. It just looked so, the colour saturation for that scene. If you wanted to show off your new, 4K TV, that scene would be perfect for it. You know, just watching the colours develop as the, the day goes on. Nothing to do with the film. It's just a transitional scene, you know, but it just blew me away. I thought it was great. But there you go.
Another thing that I thought was there's sort of a bit like, similar with The Brave, there's production budget limitations on some of the set design and that. So the villain's sort of house or stage or whatever it is, where he is like, there's the usual sort of women just sort of out of their heads, just sort of lounging around and sort of laying over each other and that. And he's like delivering speeches and that to his men, and he's got like a Scarface kind of picture in the back and stuff. But the rest of the room is like black. It's like there's nothing there. It's like they didn't want to decorate or anything.
No, so, covered everything over in black sheets.
There was a little bit of that. And then at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, I should say, before the big sort of raid happens, the underling, usurps power. He takes out the bad guy and sort of go, and then one of the guys talking, he's trying to rally the troops. Yeah. He's like, "Cheer the king who's come, who's hunting the new lord of the new lord of disaster." It's like, and they're like sort of gently clapping, and he's like trying to G them up, and there's only like a dozen of them. It's like it sounds like he's talking to like a big crowd.
I know. In his head, he probably is. But
yeah.
There's one other character in this that needs to be mentioned, and that is the blonde escort.
Oh yeah.
Who you see throughout the film.
Yeah.
In various states of undress and things, and performing certain acts on certain people, and then there's this amazing revelation towards the end, which just sort of blew me away, and I thought, oh my god, seriously, but I thought great at the end of the day. I just thought it was just so well done.
Okay, I missed that. So what was it? Because I thought she screwed him over basically, and then
she's another cover cop.
Oh, I did not catch that. I've watched it twice and I did not catch that at all.
You know when the short haired cop sort of tackles it at the ground? And she turns to her and goes, "If you don't let me go, you're going to screw up the whole operation."
Uh-huh.
And then she goes, "What?" And goes, "Yeah, the captain always said that you weren't good at sort of noticing the details." So, which is a conversation they had earlier on.
Right.
So, just...
I'm obviously not that good at noticing the details either. But isn't it funny that that's another kind of thing that happened in The Brave? So there's all these, things that are similar between these two movies that are actually really quite different, but... it's all about sort of undercover cops and divided loyalties and who do you trust and all that sort of stuff.
It's all that, and the other thing that I really enjoyed as well is at the beginning, Claudio, the cop is investigating these murders where people have been shot with two different weapons. So the bad guy shoots with his own weapon and then picks up the other guy's weapon and kills him with his own weapon basically. And there's, they realise that this guy, there's an MO to it. And towards the end of the film, he figures out who it is. And he takes precautions. And I didn't realise at the time what he was actually doing. I thought he was doing Robert Ginty out of The Exterminator when he makes his own dum-dum bullets. Because he's doing something with mercury at the end of the film, before the big climax. And I said, what's he doing there? And then at the end, you find out what it is. He was expecting this thing to happen and sort of turns the tables in quite spectacular fashion. So I was quite impressed with that. And that final reveal as well. So there's this whole sequence at the end of the film where everything's hunky-dory and they all go to Disneyland. And I was thinking, is this real? Because it all seems really, really down pat, you know. So everyone's alive, everyone's sort of hooked up with each other.
Yeah.
Everything's fine. And then all of a sudden, the film just rewinds back to that night.
Mm.
And you get this sort of stinger happen right at the end. And I just thought that looked hilariously good.
I wish I could remember what that was.
Oh. Well, let's say that a certain character isn't as dead as he thought, as everyone thinks he is.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
He's now missing an eye.
Yes, sorry, yeah, I do remember exactly. Yeah, it's like kind of that whole Masters of the Universe thing bit, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, but I thought it was a classic little moment. So.
No, yeah, you're right. Please forgive me, it was like, I first watched this about 3 weeks ago, and then I was like refresher watching it earlier, and I didn't quite get to the end, so the but I knew you'd enjoy it, so I'm glad that...
I really did enjoy this. As I said, I had no expectations of what the hell it was going to be. But yeah, if you like a sort, you like a bit of a sleazy action movie,
it is a bit sleazy.
It is a bit sleazy. You know, if you've got people in the room who don't like gratuitous nudity, you might want to sort of wait until they're not around to watch it. But it's there sitting on Amazon.
It's not by no means one of the worst. I'll say it's definitely not. It's just got a bit of an air about it in some of it. But then again, that's the world that it's portraying. It's playing to all the stereotypes and stuff, basically. So what are you going to score it, Mike?
I think just, you know, for sheer entertainment, I think I'm going to have to give it probably a 6 to a 7. I'm being generous. I'm going to give it a 7.
Okay, and we're going to have the same scoring pattern as with The Brave again, because once again, I'm going to say for a 6.
Mm. Yeah, it's by no means perfect, but it's certainly entertaining, that's for sure.
And how many Italian martial arts films do you get to see? You've got to see it just for that reason, surely.
Absolutely. Now, I do have a little niggle with Amazon Prime, not so much with the film. Putting the subtitles on, they are tiny.
Oh, that's always the case, yeah, on Amazon.
I was a bit annoyed. You know, obviously you don't want them to be obscuring the film too much, but these are like, you know, it's almost like small print at the bottom of the screen. You know, my eyesight isn't the best, so I try to sort of read this. So what's he say?
I do wonder if it's sometimes is it the device that we're watching it on that, you know, puts it in a certain way, or is it Amazon controlling it?
Because I have to say, because I'm only
all closed captions, isn't it, these days?
I am watching on like a 32 inch screen, so it's not the biggest in my sort of little flat down here.
What are you playing it through? The computer or Xbox?
Xbox. I play Netflix and Prime through Xbox.
So I'm playing it through Xbox as well. So it might be that if you're watching it on, you know, a PC or something, they might look different. It's hard for me to say. I don't know. But yeah, so it is. Sure. You do have to focus sometimes on some of those subtitles.
Now, all the films we're talking about tonight are on Prime. This is definitely worth a look. As we've said, the sort of fight sequences aren't particularly great. You know, we're fans of Scott Atkins. We know what great really looks like. But from you know, a sort of police procedural kind of thing, a bit of a sort of crime family kind of thing.
And the Rocky IV scene. You've got to see it for the Rocky IV scene.
The Rocky IV scene is superb. You know, that sort of 5-10 minutes worth of sort of training he has to do is really, really cool. Okay, so that is, I almost called it The Final Fight. That's another name for it. MMA, Love Never Dies gets a 6 and a 7 from me and Rich. Our short shot this week is Bounty. This is set in the near future where all of American society has collapsed into a kind of civil war. Where there's lots of sort of militia going around and, you know, it's sort of everything's sort of very prejudicial to race, colour, sort of sexuality, gender. And, you know, there's bounties on sort of lots of different people. We get this.
Trump's America, basically.
Basically, yeah. This is, you know, if Trump got another term, this is the sort of place it's going to end up in. So we get this really somber, really well-written title card come up, you know, setting the scene. And then it cuts to these two yahoos sort of making a YouTube video about how to hunt people in the woods. And it's really, really well done, you know, because you get the guy on camera at first, and, this looks so amateurish. But then you see the guy holding the camera who's giving him direction. And it's brilliant, you know, he's doing all these hand signals and stuff and sort of, you know, getting him to say various things. And it just looks really cool. And then, of course, it gets into the sort of story proper where they're sort of tracking this woman in the woods. She takes them out, but gets injured along the way. And ends up getting rescued by some guy, some benefactor, who sort of nurses her back to health. But then she makes a sort of kind of startling secret about him in the ensuing days. This is very well done, I thought. I liked the sort of that sort of jarring humour at the beginning, and then sort of morphing into this sort of quite sort of sweet moment, and then into this sort of more sort of darker mystery sort of later on, and then ending in a sort of pretty decent sort of throwdown fight in the woods. How about yourself, man?
Yes, very good, very nicely shot, very well paced. It's about 12 minutes long, and yeah, it covers a lot of ground. I think in terms of I think this is more of a self-contained story than a proof of concept, although you could easily see it fleshed out. I think it's comparable to something like Code 8, which I know has been fleshed out. That is going to be a feature now. The trailer, I think, for that is out and about now. But, a very relatable sort of future fascist kind of state situation, little touch of the kind of the savior is not as he seems kind of plotting, you know, there's a little bit of a sleeping with the enemy kind of vibe going on. But really at the heart of it is the action, which going in, I wasn't sure whether, although I knew that Mindy Kelly, who's the director, co-writer and star of this short, is very accomplished martial artist and stuntwoman and coordinator. She worked on her most famous work is for a film called The Art of Self-Defense with Jesse Eisenberg, which is funnily enough that's just come out on that's another case of a film that's not getting hasn't so far yet had a DVD release in the UK, but it's turned up on VOD about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but it's supposed to be very good, and she handled all the choreography for that film. Which she was getting a lot of notice for, and she was interviewed on the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast, and that's where I sort of got familiar with her. And Ben, the Kung Fu Movie Guide, tweeted about this short film, which is how we became aware of it. And it doesn't let down at all. I mean, this is the first I've really seen her, and I thought she was very impressive. She's clearly got a lot of skills. The fight scenes are ferocious, really. She has to become almost feral to survive and take on these guys. She just takes them out, quite efficiently. But the main climax, the climax of the film, which you get that nice structure where you get the characters sort of established with a fight scene, and then a bit of drama, and then a final fight, a showdown sequence. And he's a skilled fighter in his own right. And so they have a good, decent, as you say, throwdown. The one thing that grated on me slightly was that all the dialogue seemed to be like ADR'd. It's a very minor thing to be minor.
And her character never speaks at all, does she? She just sort of screams a lot, doesn't actually sort of have any sort of dialogue scenes of her own.
I can't remember, actually. Yeah, I think you're probably right. I know that the guy says quite a lot, and say those guys at the beginning, but it's because she's had to kind of retreat into herself and sort of protect herself. And we get those a bit like with with like MMA, Love Never Dies and stuff. You get a montage sequence of like training on a beach together. So where them doing the martial arts together is a bonding thing. and a trust thing, and they're sort of getting to know each other. So we're not quite sure on the time frame, but we kind of get the idea that it's been over a reasonable amount of time that it's all happening.
Yeah, because her sort of wound heals and that.
Because she gets stabbed in the side at the beginning. Yeah.
My favourite sort of moment is when he tries to hide her phone, and she spots it. She doesn't, you know, obviously doesn't say anything because she doesn't speak, but doesn't draw attention to the fact that she knows that he's still got her phone, you know, and he's charging it on the desk sort of thing. But he sort of tried to cover it up, but he forgot to cover up the power cable. So it was, you know, that sort of attention to detail I really liked, and obviously she realizes then straight away she can't trust the guy and tries to leave. I thought it was really, really well done. A little sort of moment right at the end which sort of tries, you know, gives you sort of a bit more depth to the character, and that, you know, the fact that she may have something to live for, to sort of to strive for throughout it all. So yeah, really well done.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is the potential there if they wanted to, and if they could get the funding to sort of flesh it out and make it a much bigger story. But I don't think it's necessary. I think just as it is, it's a pretty perfect little film.
I think it's a good little calling card on its own, saying, yeah, this absolutely is what we can do. Yeah. So, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. We don't score the shorts, but we, you know, this is available on Vimeo, I believe.
Vimeo, yes.
Yeah, so we'll put a link on the... you know, in the footnotes, so you can check it out for yourselves.
Now, and just go,
just before we go, move on from the short shots, we just want to mention another one which we came across. Do you want to try and pronounce this?
Stervyatnitsa.
Again, we'll put a link on. This is one scene film, as it were, featuring a woman with an interesting scar on her face who turns up at a bar. Everyone knows who she is. You know, everyone sees, expects her to sort of capitulate, but she doesn't. And, you know, chaos ensues, basically, as she takes out a whole room full of people. Really well done, really well shot, edited. We think this is being fleshed out into something bigger.
Yeah, it's part of a project called, that's on Indiegogo called Two Gun Saint, which is a Sheffield based filmmaker trying to make a heroic bloodshed style action movie up there. And this is the latest sort of little taster that's been being put out there to sort of generate interest and, you know, support for the project. You know, they've got a long way to go to get the funding they need to be able to make the Two Gun Saint feature.
Yeah.
So
this is a good start. You know,
it is
a very good start. And again, we'll put the link on so you can check it out. This is 3 minutes long, guys. You know, watch it while you're munching your sandwich at work, basically.
Yeah, and if you can, you know, sort of, you know, if you think this is something you want to get involved in, you know, have a look at their Indiegogo page, and there's, you know, there's a lot of passion here, and I think this is another example of, you know, this is the kind of movie that, you know, we really want to see made, and we want to be able to talk about on the show. Exactly. So let's hope this gets made.
Let's get this made. Okay, that is the short shots for this week. Our DTV throwbacks this week are the Corey Haim starring Demolition High and Demolition You. We'll get onto the second one later on. Demolition High is, let's be really glib, it is Die Hard in a high school. But wait, hasn't that film already been made? Wasn't that Toy Soldiers?
Well, that wasn't really Die Hard, because that was like a group of guys. So this is like one man. It's not quite, is it? Because he's got like a girl and the bully that. So yeah, it's kind of a Toy Soldiers. It's Toy Soldiers copy, really, more than Die Hard. But there's a definite Die Hard influence, obviously.
There is, but you know, this really does strike as being sort of like Jerry Bruckheimer on DTV. You know, what was the name of that company that Gary Daniels used to work for? Did loads
of PM.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it has that sort of feel to it a little bit. You know, it's sort of big explosions going on and things like that. And I must admit, I really enjoyed this. I had not seen it before. I hadn't even heard of it before. I was not really into the two Coreys, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman. They really did sort of pass me by after The Lost Boys. Even Sean Astin, it was only recently Sean Astin made an impact. But Corey Haim he has a brilliant introduction in this film. He's the new guy at school, and these three guys try to pick on him. And, he's just not having it at all. He gives all the insults back, he dodges their fists and all this sort of stuff. It's a great little scene. And it's really funny because, they're having a sort of fight. This fight's going on, throwing kicks and stuff. And the security guard turns up and goes, "Hey, I thought I told you kids no loitering in the corridor after school." And it's like, all right, forget about the fighting bit. about the sort of loitering after school. I thought it was hilarious. Really good start. And then obviously we get the bad guy sort of stealing something from somewhere and then sort of taking it to the school and setting up there. It's a great little concept, and I thought it worked really well.
So this is Corey Haim. So as you say, the two Coreys, big in the 80s, and sort of this is mid-90s now. So, Corey Haim is, he's not so much of a, name anymore, but, so he's well and truly in the sort of DTV world. He'd done a little bit of action. He'd done like Prayer of the Roller Boys and stuff, which was quite good and that. But this is him, properly playing an action hero, getting to hold a machine gun and stuff. So I think he was probably quite enjoying that. Still playing a teenager, obviously, although I'm sure
he was born far in, from 72, I think.
So, 72.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he'd have been 24.
Yeah. So, which is not uncommon for teenagers in Hollywood movies, is it? So, So he's in the school. He's got a bit of a backstory, a bit of trouble that he's got into. Although they never really establish what it was and then his father is, so the school gets taken over by terrorists basically. I don't know if you guys remember the Ray from Reef Radio adverts at the cinema for Bacardi back in the 90s or whatever. There's an actor, Jeff Kober. I've seen him in absolutely tons of stuff since then, but I'll always remember him for that because that advert was just everywhere at the time. But he's the bad guy here, Jeff Cobber. I always like seeing him. He turns up in big budget movies and stuff as well. He's a bit like a Patrick Kilpatrick kind of guy.
There's a guy in here as well, one of the henchmen, who he basically looks like Steven Seagal wearing a false nose.
Right.
Like old Steven Seagal. He's got the ponytail, he's got the droopy moustache. But he's just got more of a sort of bulbous nose. So I just thought it was really funny. Oh my God, is that Steven Seagal? because around about that time, he would have been pretty fit, So.
I just thought it was amusing. So the terrorists take over the school because they want to use it as a site to launch a rocket or something? Am I remembering that correctly? Because again, it's been a couple of weeks since I've seen it. And of course, in that whole Die Hard scenario, the authorities gather outside the school, hostage situation unfolds, and the cop outside is Alan Thicke from Growing Pains, I think, and stuff. Not the kind of actor you associate with action movies. He turns up as the...
he's the police chief, isn't he?
Coincidentally, his son, Corey Haim is playing, his son's Lenny, is in the school, and he seems to have no concern whatsoever about his son's welfare. It's like, even when his son rings him up, he's not really saying, "Well, get out of there, son. It's the dangerous kind of situation." He's like, he's kind of like, "I kind of know my son. He's gonna take care of it, all right." So he's got no worries whatsoever.
Yeah, but I did like the character sort of Chief Slater, because his dealings with the FBI, the lady who turns up,
Stacey Rand.
Trying to sort of, reel her in, because she's very gung-ho. Yeah, we're going to send the guys in, we'll blow everything up and everything. Might maybe sort of be a couple of collateral damage along the way, but, you know, we've got to stop the terrorist, man. But he's sort of like, chill, you know, we'll get him all out, just don't worry about it. The guy I felt sorry for the most was the guy at the nuclear power plant. You know, because he's on the phone, because they're telling him to sort of, you've got to switch off the lights and the power to stop the, you know, so we can stop the terrorists doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Right, so he does that. And then, like, 5 minutes later, they're like, yeah, you got to switch the power back on, otherwise they're going to kill everyone. It's like, shit, man. You know. And then so they get the other detective rings up later on and goes, yeah, they've launched the missile that's going to hit your facility very shortly. You know.
And then he does the whole, you go home and I'll stay here and look after things. And then they have that sort of, that weighty moment of, you know, pathos of that he's gonna go down with the ship. Kind of.
I just felt really sorry for him, you know, he's sort of telling him all this shit, you know. But anyway, it's quite funny. There's a couple of decent deaths in this film. One of the guys gets done out with a circular saw to the face.
Yeah, luckily we don't see it. I was like, yeah. Ah! I was really worried for a second.
It was really,
of course,
well,
it's low budget, they can't afford to show it. So.
No. But having said that, some nice explosions, there's nice miniatures exploding as well. And the, Guy on Fire, you know. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Decent Man on Fire is always
fire
a
stunts,
brilliant.
Which I thought was very good. So, yeah, overall, this is pretty decent, I thought. I thought the girl was okay. You know, she's not exactly sort of getting into the thick of it, but she's sort of quick thinking. So you know, when she sees a moment, she's sort of getting people out of the room and things like this, which I thought was really good. And I did like that sequence at the end as well, you know, when he puts on the radiation suit and sort of mingles with the other guys so he can sort of confront the bad guy at the end. I thought it was very well done.
This is directed by Jim Wynorski, and the opening of the film, for Jim Wynorski fans, will just, you know, they'll just be in heaven as soon as the film starts, because we've got George Buck Flower as a security guard character, and Buck Flower's been, he usually plays homeless guys. He's in pretty much everything, like Back to the Future and stuff. I think that's one of the most famous was the Back to the Future role and that. So he's doing that. He's turning up there. And then Melissa Brussell, who's kind of the obligatory sexy female member of the terrorist team, which was like, it was always a convention of, you know, you always had to have that token female character.
Absolutely.
So sort of up the
You don't have a group of terrorists or you know, sort of bank robbers posing as terrorists unless you've got a sexy female, you know, in the mix.
Yeah.
You know,
One time I watched the film. I can't remember the film I watched, but it was quite recently. But they had two. And I was like, wow, there's two of them in this one.
the only team who didn't was Tommy Lee Jones's crew from Under Siege. I'm pretty sure. Maybe Under Siege 2 as well didn't have any.
What about Die Hard?
Die Hard didn't. But
yeah.
Die Hard 3 did. So if you
take Die Hard 3 definitely.
Die Hard 3 as the start of the craze. Moving on forward. Yeah.
And she's quite fun actually. I've seen her in quite a few things, and she's sort of quite a lively presence in that. So she's sort of playing off the villain Jeff Cobber. They're kind of like a couple kind of thing leading the thing. Good fun. So there's a lot of Jim Wynorski sort
Jim
of.
Jim Wynorski, if you don't know. He has got 103 directorial credits to his name. You know, the last sort of 10, 15 years, he's been doing sort of like sub-asylum kind of stuff. Films with titles like The Hills Have Thighs, Busty Cops Go Hawaiian.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's done a lot of softcore stuff. He uses pseudonyms quite a lot, and he makes action movies, he makes softcore
Legend
porn films,
naked
stuff. Yeah, he's all over the place.
Absolutely. But,
another note that I'd written was about...
he did Chopping Mall as well.
Sorry?
He did Chopping Mall.
Yes, which is one I keep thinking of suggesting for us to do, because I've always wanted to see it.
Yeah, it's something we're seeing. Yeah.
The Alan Thicke's character, say, yeah. Slater, that he'd reminded me of Frank Drebin, but yeah. but without the jokes.
It's sort of like, yeah, it's Frank Drebin or the guy from, you know, was it... What's the actor called? Is it Jackie Gleason? The guy from Die Hard. You know, the police guy in that one. You know, this people showered with glass in here. You know, it's a really officious one. The guy played the principal in The Breakfast Club.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't think of his name.
Can't remember his name.
But I do know that. I know you're talking about
Jackie, Jackie somebody.
Yeah,
but yeah, that sort of thing. But
yeah. He's very much like very much like that. Yeah. So the Chernobyl style sort of stakes of it are kind of a bit interesting, because the film tries to sort of be quite weighty at times, which seems a bit.
Yeah, we're talking about those scenes with the nuclear power plant kind.
Yeah.
But again, it's you know it's a classic Die Hard. Blueprint where it's all a ruse so they can do something else.
Yeah.
But they never get round to doing this something else. It's like, you know, the cops guess, oh yeah, they're going to try and rip off the, you know, all the money that's gone to the incinerator sort of thing, you know. But you're never really sure whether or not that was their plan or what, you know, because they never get round to it. Obviously, their plan doesn't get that far. But yeah, it's quite funny. So yeah, this was a, you know, it's an enjoyable sort of little movie. Again, it's sitting there on Amazon Prime, guys. So if you've got an account, you know, you've got no excuse. Go check it out.
And at the end of Demolition High, we get a little note that says, "Coming soon, Demolition High 2, The College Years."
I didn't notice that.
It wasn't called Demolition High 2, but what it was called was
Demolition U, or Demolition University.
And the problem with this one, unlike the first one, is that you don't actually get a university. In the first one, you did get a school.
You did get a school. So
in this one, they have to leave the university pretty much as soon as we get there.
Which is hilarious the way it's done. So Corey Haim returns as Lenny Slater, still a wisecracking, you know, guy getting into trouble. Again, you know, stuff out of his control. Still getting on the wrong side of the jocks and the bullies, trying to chat up one of the sort of female athletes. And in order to sort of get out of the way of the bullies, he basically hides on this school bus, which is going on a school trip to the local water power plant, which is, you know, his intended girlfriend is also going to be on, as well as one of the jocks as well, who's out for him. But it turns out they've picked the wrong day, and poor old Lenny must be asking himself, how can the same shit happen to the same guy twice? Because as soon as he gets there, he notices that the security guard has an AK-47 stashed in his little booth, and there's a dead body sort of like half hidden in the trash, but nobody else notices. And then he gets sort of told to stay on the bus while everyone goes inside. So this is kind of more of the same in a slightly different setting, basically.
Yeah, it's near identical, basically.
It is near identical.
They've essentially just rewritten the script, because even the sort of character dynamics between Lenny and, you know, a bully character and the love interest character sort of plays out in exactly the same way. Even the opening of the film, the opening scene is basically the exact same.
It's exactly the same scene. Thing. The bad guys raid a place to nick something so they can take it to somewhere else and make their demands.
What we get here is a bit of this one's influenced by The Rock. So yeah. we've got like Deadly Chemical Weapon and Renegade Soldier with a Grudge.
Yeah, so we've got all that, which does add a really interesting dynamic towards the end of the film. Mm. So we got this guy who we find out that he'd been sent on a suicide mission by his commanding officer. He survived the mission, but he had to sort of, you know, live out in the desert for days on end in order to evade sort of the enemy. You know, came back sort of disavowed, basically, and you know, with a huge chip on his shoulder, and ends up working with these Iraqi terrorists to steal a chemical so they can be put into the water supply if their demands aren't met. This soldier guy is, you know, he's a lot more. He's a much more a sort of Tommy Lee Jones character from Under Siege. You know, he's very talkative. He's very sort of jokey. He looks a bit like Mike Myers. Not Mike Myers. Seth. Who's the guy that does Family Guy?
Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane. He sort of looks a bit more sort of like him. You know, he's a bit more sort of jokey. And then you got the sort of, you know, these Iraqi terrorists who are sort of supposedly on a jihad and, you know, ready to sort of, you know, show their faith, as it were, by, you know, sort of giving their lives to the cause, which again has a very funny moment at the end of the film, which I really enjoyed. As you say, it's more of the same. But then we got we've got Robert Forster in the mix this time, playing sort of the general. He adds a nice element to it. And is it the same female FBI agent from the first one?
I don't think so. I think they're all different characters now, apart from.
But she is basically playing the same kind of. Oh no, this one's a she's a behavioral analyst, I think, sent by the FBI to sort of, you know, give a psychological report on this soldier who's gone rogue.
Yeah. They just rejigged it all, basically. It's essentially the same film, but it just like knocked things around a bit.
Yeah.
And we've got Amy Dillens as the love interest this time. Who's do you know who Amy Dillens is married to?
I don't know. I was wondering.
A little trivia moment.
I was wondering if she might be related to Mickey Dillens.
It's Mickey Dillens' daughter, yes.
Oh, it is, right, yeah.
But do you know who she's married to?
No, I don't.
Jerry Trimble.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. Yeah. So she did a few films with Corey Haim, I think, like Just One of the Guys and stuff. I think.
I had a bit of sympathy for the actress at the beginning of this film, because she has to suffer through this really gratuitous cleavage shot, where she's on a athletics scholarship and you know, she's practicing her sprinting. Which again comes in later in the film to good effect. They utilize that quite well. But the very first thing, they got the, you know, she has to sort of get on her marks right in front of the camera, and the camera is just staring down her t-shirt at her boobs, basically. And it's like, really? And the look on her face as well, you know, there's just this moment where her face just says, shit. You know? Do I really have to do this? This is what I have to do to be in films.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate.
That was the time then. This is and interestingly, it's not Jim Wynorski, who's very much a breast man.
Yeah.
It's not his him directing. This time it's Kevin Tenney, who actually worked with Amy Dillens previously on Witchboard 2 in 1993. But Kevin Tenney's more well known for horror movies generally than action, although. He's done quite a variety of stuff, really.
Yeah.
But I and don't think.
Yeah, I thought she was pretty decent in it, actually.
I think so. I think they were all fine. I mean, Robert Forster was good. You know, you can't go wrong with Robert Forster. There's not enough of him in it because he kind of exits.
I do like Corey Haim's dialogue scenes at the beginning. You know, as with the first film, he has a really good rapport with. The other characters, and with Amy Dillens in particular, where they're having this sort of like, you know, sort of flirty sparring match, you know, sort of punning on each other and things like that. And it's just really, really well done, you know, well written and well performed. So, yeah, that was
his trademark, wasn't it? That kind of witty banter. Between the characters.
You know, other than The Lost Boys, I hardly saw anything any of his
work, unfortunately. Not License to Drive.
No, I never saw that one.
No, oh, that's a classic. But, yeah, I mean, he's done a variety of stuff, but he's kind of been those, you know, being the sort of cheeky, sort of smart mouth, smart aleck kind of character. You know, it's kind of, he's done a lot of that. Yeah, I think, I'd say, this is not as good as Demolition High. I think, you know, the you don't get as quite as much... even the explosions and stuff aren't as good. It's, yeah. it's almost like the budget got considerably slashed.
Yeah, and it's hard watching these films back to back. I mean, I've watched them both over the course of a weekend. So, you know, there is definitely that sort of feeling of the, you know, sort of the law of diminishing. What's the word I'm looking for?
Return.
Now? Yeah, the law of diminishing returns happening. But and because they are so familiar, you know, the terrorists. Yes, they do have a feisty female on their team. There's another good fire stunt. Is actually, you know, it's actually a better fire stunt than was in the first one. Yeah, then we get some nice explosions as well, which sort of remind me of the PM Entertainment sort of like motif. But I like the ending. You know, well, the you know, we got these bad guys because you have these two sort of factions within the bad guys. And then you got Robert Forster, who's sort of winding them up, even though he's been told, "Don't wind them up, for God's sake! You know, you're going to make matters worse." And but I just really like that sort of moment where, basically, you know, the bad guy team just implodes, and it's almost like everyone for themselves at that point. And the other thing I really liked was the ending, where the sort of the brother is sort of saying, "Right, it's your turn to die. You know, it's your turn to give your life for the cause." And she's like, "No, this was your mission, not mine. You're the one who's supposed to die on this one." And he's like, "What? No, no, I got to go back to the homeland." And, you know, she's going, "Well, I can do that for you. Thank you very much." Yeah, I just thought it was really cool.
I agree with you. I think the interplay between the villains is much more interesting in this one because of that uneasy alliance between the two, you know, the motivations being so different between the the guys out for revenge, and they're on their sort of
sort of Broken Arrow kind of thing, isn't it? You know, sort the main guy is just so unhinged. He's like, fuck him if they don't take a joke, sort of thing. Which is, that was quite cool.
I made a mistake earlier when I said that Amy Delenz had done Just One of the Girls with Corey Haim. I was getting her confused with Nicole Eggert. I just watched. Just in case anybody sort of notices that and sort of picked me up on it, I just wanted to address it now. Nicole Eggert was the one who's Corey Haim worked quite a lot with. They did a Blown Away and stuff with her as well. But just on a final note about Corey Haim for you, as in, I think you'd probably be. I think you should check out the Fast Getaway movies because they united Corey Haim with Cynthia Rothrock. Which is an interesting dynamic. So you've kind of got that sort of teen adventure kind of movie, but with Cynthia Rothrock and the sort of martial arts action in there as well, and a few other people, and some nice sort of car action. So they'd be worth them. They probably actually. I'm not so familiar with the second one, but I think, you know, at least the first one would be worth checking out.
Cool. Okay.
Well, any final thoughts on those?
Not really. Again, you know, as I said, I hadn't really sort of watched Corey Haim films, and I wasn't aware of these pairings until you mentioned them the other day for this episode. But going into them, you know, I must admit, I had a sort of a guilty pleasure watching them. You know, I think.
Well, I know you have a soft spot for these high school action movies and stuff, like the Substitute movies.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got those sort of watch. I was thinking about putting together a sort of top 10 sort of high school movies, but you know, this sort of thing. Because I only recently saw Class of 1984.
Class of 1984.
Yeah, Class of 1984. I got the Arrow Blu-ray a while back. So you know, that's a film that I've been meaning to see for 30 years or so. You know. But that was really cool, and but the sequel to it is even better, Class of 1999. Although that was amazing.
Yeah, and Class of 1999 too is quite a lot of fun as well with Sasha Mitchell from the kickboxer movies.
I'll have to dig that one out next. But so this was a fun couple of films. They're not going to blow anyone away at all. But Corey Haim, you know, if you're not familiar with him, check him out because he's pretty cool in this. He died about 10 years ago now, is it?
I'm not sure exactly when, but yeah, he sort of several years ago. He did like The Lost Boys.
He did the Lost Boys sequel as well.
Or no, was he in 3 or was he just in 2? I can't remember. He turned up. He reprised his role from The Lost Boys at least briefly. I can't. I'm drawing a blank, but yeah, he turned up in Crank 2. He turned up in as well.
He did,
but he was largely in sort of very much in DTV land until he passed away, basically.
I mean, watching this, you know, I think he was sort of ripe for a reprisal. You know, his sort of level of banter and things, I think, you know, somebody should have sort of rediscovered him, and given him a decent script.
I think that's what they tried to do with when they got Corey Haim and Feldman back for
The Lost Boys 3.
The reality show, I was thinking. They did a reality show called The Two Coreys, and I think they were really trying to sort of get them back, you know, sort of get that banter back between those guys again. Yeah. And I think that was quite successful for a bit. But, yeah, I think Corey...
Corey Feldman had a lot to say about the pair's past, didn't they, as well? Sort of, you know, there's a lot of allegations about sort of them being... You know, abuse as kids.
Yes. Yeah, I think he's been quite vocal about that. Yeah.
But which is, you know, it's sad, but But this is a decent sort of tribute. If you've seen the likes of The Lost Boys, License to Drive, you know, then yeah, these are sort of two little sort of tarnished gems to check out.
Amazon's got another one I want to check out as well called The 00 Kid, which I've always wanted to see, which is which has got Bridget Nielsen in it.
Okay, sold. Yes, okay. Awesome. That is the end of this particular episode. So this new format. As I said, check out our Twitter account, the DTV Digest, and also our Facebook page, where we, you know, regularly put out things about the DTV chart, and we're going to start sort of putting out a few trailers and things that we like and letting you know what's coming out as well. This will be mainly just the reviews from now on. So thank you for listening and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.